You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LP FM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source, we talk to Katrina Fontanella about her new detailed plan recently presented to the Public Art Commission that looks at the need for and the transformative potential of artists' live-in workspaces in Richmond. Also, legalized gay marriage may well be just a few months away, with two pivotal cases before the U.S. Supreme Court this summer. We talk with one local couple who were among the first in Virginia to have their union blessed in a ceremony sanctioned by the Virginia Diocese of the Episcopal Church, as well as the priest who performed the service, about the past and future of gay unions. But first, here are the headlines happening right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. This week, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli has petitioned to get anti-sodomy laws back on the books. In March, Virginia's Crimes Against Nature statute, which bans oral and anal intercourse between consenting adults, was overturned by the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Richmond, in accordance with the 2003 Supreme Court decision Lawrence v. Texas, that found such laws to be unconstitutional and therefore unenforceable. The case that saw Virginia's anti-sodomy law overruled was not what one might expect, but involved a 47-year-old man, William Scott McDonald, soliciting a 17-year-old teenage girl for oral intercourse. The Court of Appeals' decision was that an unconstitutional law could not be used to convict McDonald. Cuccinelli spokesperson Caroline Gibson told the Washington Blade that the Attorney General believes the dissenting judge on the three-judge panel was correct in stating that the Lawrence decision applies only to sex between consenting adults in private and doesn't apply to cases involving a minor. Cuccinelli's camp stresses that this is about protecting minors, not criminalizing consensual sex between adults. In 2004, a suggested revision of the Crimes Against Nature law, which would have legally ensured just this end, was actively opposed by Cuccinelli, who was quoted in 2009 as saying that homosexual acts are wrong and that in a natural law-based country, it's appropriate to have policies to reflect that. Do you have an unfinished project of shame gathering real or metaphorical dust in your basement, your hard drive, or even your brain? That's what Bill wants to know this Saturday. Not Clinton or Gates or Cosby or even your nosy neighbor. Bill bills itself as a smaller, humbler conference, or as co-organizers Sam Davies and Ren Lanier sometimes call it, an unconference. The focus is on making things, especially very small, simple things, and you, yes you, are invited to speak about your goals, your failures, and carrying on. The Bill Conference goes down this Saturday, April 6th, from 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the 804 RVA co-working space at 1657 West Broad Street. That's not too far from us fine folks at 97.3 WRIR. And the $12.50 admission covers breakfast. Further information can be found at billconference.com.
Becky Lee and Diane Hoover first met in 1983. Introduced by a mutual friend, Becky's then roommate, both felt the spark. But it wasn't until the next year that they came together. They dated for a year, but Diane worried about their 7-year age difference. They parted ways. But a year later, the two realized apart wasn't where they wanted to be. They moved in together in 1986 and bought a house together the next year. They've shared the same Northside Richmond address, the same phone number, longer than most legal marriages last. They helped raise and bury each other's families, and last October, after 28 years together, the pair finally stood in front of their community, St. Mark's Episcopal Church, and made official what they'd committed to nearly 3 decades earlier. Ask them, and the two say they've done nothing special. Nonetheless, theirs was among the first same-sex blessings of the union ceremonies officially sanctioned by the Virginia Episcopal Diocese. The moment was made even more poignant when just a few months later the U.S. Supreme Court decided it would hear cases considering the constitutionality of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage. America's realization that it had gay friends, a brother, a sister, a neighbor, has been an awkward coming out event. While today's polls show the majority of Americans favoring gay unions, it wasn't always that way. And for what remains a large majority, acceptance literally is a religious line they cannot cross. The highest court in the land may or may not decide on those cases sometime later this summer. Whatever the decisions of the court, they won't end the debate, and they won't soften the strong emotions people feel on both sides of that debate. But at the end of the day, gay marriage is about two people. It's about Becky and Diane. I am with Becky Lee, the YWCA's program officer for Richmond, Diane Hoover, her significant other and a retiree of the U.S. Postal Service, Buck Aiken, he's a retired Episcopal priest who remains an assistant at St. Mark's Church, and notably who performed among the first sanctioned same-sex blessings in the Diocese of Virginia, the Episcopal Diocese, and Bill Harrison, executive director of the Richmond Gay Community Foundation. Thank you guys for being with me today. And this is an interesting time, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. I guess first, maybe talk with Becky and Diane a little bit about when did you guys come together? You've been together for a long time, it sounded like.
Yes, we've been together for 28 years. So I don't know what year it was, but it was a long time ago. I was a young woman.
Are you allowed not to remember the year?
No, I just came backwards that quick. Actually, it was 1986.
And came together, knew it was the real thing? And
well, we had dated a little bit before then, one summer before then, and went our separate ways, and then re-met and decided that, yes, this was really what it was. Shortly after we moved in together, we had a ceremony that was between the two of us and God. And we had written vows and said them to one another. And from that point forward, we lived in a monogamous relationship as two married people would. This past summer, the news came out that we would have the opportunity or might have the opportunity for our church that we hold very near and dear to bless our union.
Now, this is St. Mark's?
This is St. Mark's Episcopal Church.
And you guys have been members for how long?
Maybe about 10 years.
Yeah. So. And we were ecstatic. They announced it. We sort of looked at each other and said, okay, let's go see Buck. And made the arrangements, and we had a blessing of our union in the Episcopal Church. We had about 140 guests, straight, gay,
old, young, children,
babies, 80-year-olds, everybody, people we knew. We sent out invitations. We did get a few responses back from folks saying, you know, I'm sorry I can't attend. This is against my faith. That was okay.
Our point was for them to know that we included them, and that was really all that mattered for that. It didn't matter that they felt they couldn't.
The one and only Buck is here with us. And I guess that's an interesting thing. This is just last year that this ceremony took place, and it, again, is among the first in the diocese. The Episcopal Diocese here in Richmond. We were talking a little bit before the interview, and Buck, you were saying that this was something that was kind of a long time coming. The previous bishop believed in it, but wasn't really ready to take the step. This current bishop was the one who sort of opened the pathway.
Yes. Bishop Johnston, the bishop of the Diocese of Virginia, made it very clear that this was something he wanted done in this diocese. And it was worked on for several years before he announced his approval for his clergy to bless same-sex unions. And to get that approval, I had to send in some paperwork and do some different things. And I had talked to him about this, when he first came to the diocese, that St. Mark's deserved to be one of the first churches because we have a large gay membership, and we have always been supportive at St. Mark's of the diocese, even when they were dragging their feet maybe on the same-sex blessing. None of our members, not a single one, bolted or did anything that was disrespectful to the wishes of the diocese. So we felt we would do.
Now, you had, again, you'd said before the broadcast that this was something that you felt was very important for the diocese to do, for you to do, for your support.
Yes.
Of this was,
yes,
was more than just, it's a neat thing. You had said this was the right thing to do.
Yes, it theologically, I believe it's the right thing to do, to bless the union of two people, no matter their sex, who are in a committed relationship and are seeking the church's blessing of that relationship. That's a proper thing to do. And I think the public, if you read the polls now, the public is coming around to this view, I mean, really, like gangbusters.
And some of these polls are showing 60% approval or higher.
Yeah, well, whatever they are, even in the state of Virginia, it's getting up into the high 40s. And St. Mark's has been a very faithful church within the diocese. Our gay members of St. Mark's have been very, very faithful to St. Mark's and to the Diocese of Virginia.
It sounded to me, too, like what you were trying to get across, too, is that the gay community in general is just important to the church, has been a faithful partner to
yes.
the church.
Yes, it has.
Not just to St. Mark's, but that through history? Or is that what you meant? That's sort of what it sounded like you meant, was that this is a much deeper relationship.
Yes, I think the Episcopal Church in the United States has been generally more liberal, Bill, than most churches, than most denominations. Excuse me.
I think so. Becky and I both grew up Baptist, and has nothing to do with it. It's an ironic twist. I'm Episcopalian. I converted back in 1981. And what drew me to the Episcopal Church was I had been married for 3 years to a woman, and we got a divorce. And I went church shopping. And I knew I did not want to remain in the Baptist church because of my sexual orientation. And I visited several churches, and I went to St. Paul's Episcopal, and the priest, the rector, Craig Biddle, preached a sermon that Sunday entitled Different But No Less Decent, talking about gay and lesbian people. And I thought, this is no accident. And I've been there ever since.
Divine providence, so to speak.
Well, and I think that they're really the reason that we go to St. Mark's, the reason that we are connected to St. Mark's, was because we were looking for a place that was not... we ourselves were looking for a place that wasn't exclusive or separate, but we really wanted it to be a part of our everyday life and a part of other people in a very diverse and open kind of environment where everybody brought gifts to the table and everybody accepted what those gifts were. And that's what we found at St. Mark's, was a community of people that was very diverse. Mm-hmm. And not only welcomed us as individuals and as a couple, but gave us opportunities to grow and experience that growth in a really healthy environment. And so it wasn't just that the church benefited from having people who were loyal. The loyalty came from the environment created and the culture created within the church. And not every parish has that, but ours does.
We were talking again a little bit before the broadcast, sort of, I guess, about the evolution of some of our local churches. The Episcopal Church has long been more supportive of these things. And meanwhile, the Catholic Diocese in Richmond had been a remarkably supportive Catholic diocese in terms of its gay community. And Richmond has a substantial gay community. a substantial gay Catholic gay community, and they for a long time were kept brought into the church by Bishop Sullivan, recently deceased. But then with the new bishop coming in, I guess what was about 4 or 5 years ago now. Seems like just yesterday, and there was a sort of a sea change, I guess, in terms of the local diocese, how they dealt with their gay community. In fact, they didn't anymore. They moved them out, essentially. It's interesting to see some of the evolution in recent years where it's almost like an ebb and flow in a lot of these churches. Again, there was a headline, I think it was day before yesterday, with or it might have been today, Bishop Dolan, in Boston, I think. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
The Boston Diocese, the Catholic Church, saying we should be better with gay people, kinder to them. We shouldn't exclude them. Why this push-pull with churches and how they approach or reapproach or push out their gay membership that seems to want to be a part of a community? Obviously, I'm addressing here, Buck.
Yeah, I know. You're getting into a theological discussion because I really don't want to criticize any denomination for the stand they take.
Certainly, I mean
it's their business, not ours in the Episcopal Church, and they choose to be a little more on the conservative side of the spectrum. And their leadership and their membership maybe want that. I'm thinking of some of the more fundamental denominations, not thinking so much along the Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, more mainline churches. But I think it would be safe to say that most mainline churches in America, which is the only thing I'm familiar with, are becoming more and more open every day to the sexual orientation of their members and are seeing that every member is a valued child of God that has needs and can contribute to that church, their own talents, and may need nurturing by the church itself, without going into pushing that envelope of conservative and liberal too much. And some denominations have chosen to be, from their leadership down, much more conservative and are sticking to that tooth and nail.
So it's going to be easier, and we haven't really touched on this yet, but the Supreme Court, again, dealing with what they're dealing with now, these two cases, DOMA, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Defense of Marriage Act, and then Proposition 8 in California. These two things have come up rather suddenly, but again, it's been sort of a slow change culturally. But then again, also it's been a rapidly increasing pace in that change, the cultural change. What has shifted? Do you guys get any sense of what's shifted in our culture to allow, first of all, the general population to suddenly be so willing to, not necessarily embrace, but to at least hold hands in fellowship with people that before they were perfectly willing to
exclude? I think a lot of it has to do with it's been this movement's been going on for a very long time, but people have gotten to know each other, and it's, to me, it's not rocket science. Whether it's race or what the issue is, once we get to know each other, we realize that we have a lot more in common than we do in difference. And I also think that with the younger generation, and the polls are showing that, it's not an issue with them. What was an issue with people in my generation is not an issue with the younger people, because they have become more aware, they're more educated, and more people have come out of the closet, which is the key to a lot of this. I think back during the AIDS epidemic, if there was one blessing with AIDS, it was that we realized how many gay people we knew that we weren't aware of. Our brothers and our friends and sons were having to come out to us because they were dying. And it was an unfortunate way to do it, but I think that people coming out over time, and, you know, also, when I was a kid, we didn't have lobbyists. We didn't have gays on and lesbians on TV for the most part. And now you can hardly turn on TV that there's not a gay character on there. And that's unfortunately how a lot of people are educated. And so it's becoming more the norm. And, you know, I think it's interesting with all this discussion about religion. I think that straight people could learn a lot from us about marriages, because you look at all the support that straight people have with their marriages. From the time we're born, we're indoctrinated on get married, have kids, go to college, and all the support from the church and the community and the government, and yet they have a 50% divorce rate every year. Well, and we all know people, gay and lesbian people, who've been in relationships many, many years, and we've never enjoyed the support that straight people do. So I think it's interesting if they'd stop fighting us and listen to us that some of their marriages might get a little healthier.
And I'm sitting across the table again from two people who have been together for 28 years. That's a long time for, you know, anything. However you measure it. And, you know, you were saying too and I thought that this was a very interesting point. One of the justices during the arguments, how did he put it? We're dealing with something.
He said something to the effect of, you're asking me to condone something that's younger than cell phones. And
meaning homosexuality
is
younger
than? Yes, well, same-sex marriage. That's not been around too long. And what scares me about that is, here's a man who's going to make a pivotal decision here, and he's so unaware of the reality of what he's talking about. Because we've been having service of unions or...
Yeah,
we've been falling in love since day one and being committed to each other, just because. And I know we did it as Becky and Diane did between the two of them. It didn't matter whether or not the government. That wasn't the reason that we were doing it. We were doing it because we loved each other.
Now, again, that was 20 plus years ago, and the two of you in the privacy of your own home.
Right. Exactly.
And it was exactly for that reason. It meant something to us. It didn't matter, and we really at that point never thought. We kind of knew at some point in time, maybe this time would actually get there, but we certainly didn't figure it was going to happen much in our time, so we did what we could do.
Did you feel like you were doing that in the eyes of one another or in the eyes of God?
Absolutely. Well, in the eyes of God.
Yeah.
He was there.
So there's a...
There have been clergy that have been blessing unions of same-sex couples for many, many years. And Bill and Diane and Becky know clergy that have performed this blessing 20 and 30 years. And it just...
It was kept quiet. I think like a lot of issues, and I think that Bill was talking about it a minute ago. I mean, I grew up during integration. And for the kids who were being integrated, the kids in the school, I was young, Buck, but the kids in the school, it was not an issue for the kids who were coming together at that point, but it was still an issue for the parents. And I think that much like that, it is a social issue that has evolved over time. And everything, all types of issues, reach at some point in time a tipping point or sort of a critical mass where it has to go from being a quiet evolution to all of a sudden what feels like a big splash, but it's not a big splash. It's just the next step. And because there are more pieces in place for us now and more networks that we communicate through, we have more tools.
I think it's really interesting, Bill, you made the point that, and I'd never really thought of it this way, that the AIDS epidemic really sort of opened a community conversation, a national, international community conversation. It sort of forced the gay community out of the closet as a community.
A lot of people got outed.
Do you think we would still be not having these conversations without AIDS?
You can't say that.
You know, I don't know, but I know that did. You know, I think this. No matter how the Supreme Court decision goes, I think we've won so much because it's made this issue national conversation, and it's not going to go away.
It's likely to come back, you think.
And there were two excellent pieces in a paper this morning that I read. One of them talked about that sexual orientation is not anything that's chosen. And that's one of the things that organizations like the Family Foundation love to toss out there, that it's chosen. It's not chosen. And I think that's a similarity when we talk about Judge Clarence Thomas, who's married to a Caucasian woman, that I would like for him to realize that 50 years ago in the Commonwealth of Virginia, his marriage would have been illegal. And he didn't choose his skin color any more than I or Becky or Diane chose our sexual orientation.
That's right.
There's so much similarities in that. And that is what I have known from day one when I realized about myself. I didn't choose it any more than I chose the color of my skin. So when you're talking about how God feels about it, I don't think God has an issue with it, because God understands. And that it's no difference. And we would never purposely discriminate against a person because of their color. It's wrong, and it's immoral and illegal. And that's the way it should be with sexual orientation and sexual identity.
Now, going back to the I guess, the issue of color, in not too long past, in fact, I guess we're celebrating right now, or it's commemorating the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, which was something that sort of, I guess, allowed African Americans more into our society as a full-fledged person. Personhood, so to speak. And prior to that, there were traditions in that community that were, again, sort of like this union that you guys performed in private, secret, in your own home, that were like that, that were traditions that they held that grew up around these parts of their lives that had to be kept secret. Religion, in particular, was one. There, near Richmond, there are a number of places that are commemorated as places where these African American churches would meet in secret when they were not condoned to meet at all. Bill, you were talking about some of or you mentioned one that you knew of that was sort of a ceremony that was unique to the gay community. I've never heard of anything like this.
Well, it was two women who got married 9 or 10 years ago at Metropolitan Community Church here in town. And it's a very traditional wedding until the very end, when they signed their last will and testament and their powers of attorney and those legal documents in front of everybody. And when I saw in the program they were going to do that, I thought, this is the weirdest. Why are you going to disrupt this beautiful ceremony with something like that? But it was one of the most powerful things I have ever seen, and I've never forgotten it. And it was something that heterosexual people probably take for granted. They never think about. But these two women knew that to be legally recognized in some way, their relationship, to ensure that such something happened to one of them, that their wishes would be carried out, that they had to have it documented by an attorney, and to do it in front of everybody. Powerful is the word that I use.
Are there other traditions like that in I guess gay ceremonies that are commemorating weddings, or for that matter funerals?
I don't know that the ones I've been to have been, you know, I going back to, if I just talk about AIDS for one more second, I think when you and I were talking about this the other day, something that came to my mind was the funerals that we created, because funerals were traditional services. You do it the same way, no matter who you are. And we started creating our own. And I think that you've seen those services, the celebrations of life, with people mm-hmm. in the congregation having the opportunity to speak or doing particular things that some people might consider odd, but now they've been incorporated into more mainstream. So I think...
And I guess that's it. It's what's kind of neat about it is now that it's been brought out into the open, those things that were once something you would never do at a traditional funeral are now part of mainstream funerals.
Well, I think we don't realize it when it's happening, but when you realize, at least when we were growing up, when you're 14, 15 years old, that you're a homosexual, and you have to go look the word up in the dictionary, and then you know there's been another one in the world because you saw the word, you get stuff thrown at you, and you learn how to cope with it. And I look at young people today, and they have no idea the history of the gay, lesbian, GLBT community, as young African Americans have no idea of what their parents and grandparents went through. But any minority, you get stuff thrown at you, and you learn how to deal with it, and it makes you stronger in the run.
Well, and I think that you know, it's one of those times when you have a little bit of an aha moment that you swore you'd never have. Mm-hmm. And that was when you go, I sound just like my parents. Because you think, you realize that, and a little bit of an example was there was a march on Washington several years ago, and there was a group there that was very different from me, who was gay, but very different from me and what I looked like and acted like on a normal basis. And I had an initial, oh God, I wish they wouldn't do that because, you know, people react to that. And then at the same time, my next thought was, thank God they did what they did, because if there aren't people who are willing to do that, it doesn't put me out there. And so it's a bit of a challenge. And I think that there is a long history of doing things based on tradition. And I think that part of what a younger generation is bringing forward is that we're making more decisions based on the concept of justice. And so that tradition meant as it's always been, and justice has taken on a new appeal. It's a new, you know, it's a new thing to shout. It's a new champion. And
the
it's,
way we always thought it should have been, maybe?
or maybe the way some people always thought it should have been, but it has really, it's become a little bit more of a vision. So I think that where decisions were being made based on tradition, that now there's a much larger concept of justice. So it gives us a different perspective. And one of the things that I thought was unique and great about our ceremony, aside from the fact that it was in a more traditional church, was that although it had been months in preparation of being prepared what the service would look like, it looked like the other couple's ceremonies who were getting married in the church. I wasn't getting a different kind of blessing than the straight couples who were getting blessed in the church. And it normalized that in a way that was incredibly powerful.
Buck, I'm assuming you guys, in coming up with the first, again, the name itself was something you...
Well, actually, we didn't do it. It was a service that was developed out of the marriage service that is in the Episcopal Prayer Book that was tweaked by a committee in the Diocese of Northern California. And they did this beautiful job of changing words here and there and adding stuff. But it was the same basic marriage ceremony that we have. But Bill brought up the most important point of all. It's not, in blessing of same-sex unions is important. But what's really important is for same-sex unions to have equality in the law and in the business community as heterosexual couples have that are married. We got to get this legal thing so that everybody's on the same footing. And that's the big issue for me is...
And we talked, obviously, about the theology of it because that's going to be the most difficult in terms of cultural, but it really is, I mean, what we're dealing with right now.
We got to get the legal stuff straight.
Sure. And that's what the Supreme Court is looking at. How do we...
We hope they are. We don't know they are. We just hope.
They're at least looking, listening. They're listening at it.
We do hope, but I think that there's so much what Bill said about people knowing other people, that even if they're a member of a faith community that does not condone, does not agree, and in some ways is very anti same-sex unions and very much anti-homosexuality in general, there are individuals within those congregations who still remain individuals. And you jokingly almost went to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but in some ways the churches, all churches have for a very long time
had their own Don't
Ask, operated
Don't
Tell. With Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that worked for them. They benefited, everybody benefited, because everybody knew a lot of people, but they didn't talk about it. If you didn't talk about it, you weren't doing anything against your religion, so all was good. So it was really a don't ask, don't tell within the churches, and I think that has changed a good bit.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for being here. This has been an interesting conversation. I've been with Becky Lee. She's a YWCA's program officer for Richmond. And I should say, right after her, Diane Hoover, her wife. Is that how you refer to one another?
Sure.
Wife and wife. Retiree from the U.S. Postal Service. Buck Aiken, who performed the ceremony in October of last year that brought them finally together after 28 years in the eyes of the church, but not in the eyes of God. And he is a retired Episcopal priest who remains an assistant with St. Mark's Church, and Bill Harrison, executive director of the Richmond Gay Community Foundation. Thank you guys for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And there'll be flowers, baby, for you and me.
Everybody knows not to put their hands in the mouth of a poisonous snake, but accidents happen. If a poisonous snake bites you or someone you know, call Poison Help at 1-800-222-1222 right away. Their experts will determine if the snake is poisonous and tell you what signs to watch for and what to do. If the snake is not poisonous, you will need to wash the wound and check with your doctor. You may need a tetanus booster shot.
Somewhere at City Hall or in the broom closet of one of our many business consortiums, sitting gathering dust is a teeming pile of plans. Plans commissioned, requested, and paid for, but never acted on. Many of these initiatives concern our creative community and our growing problem of housing. Let's hope that Katrina Fontenla's new proposal, requested by the Public Art Commission, doesn't end up rotting on that pile. Her paper, titled A Plan to Accommodate Artists' Live Workspaces in Richmond, is a thoughtful and exhaustively researched proposal that identifies the many ways that Richmond can address the problem of affordable artist live workspaces. Richmond can easily become a haven for creativity by accommodating artists, she writes in her introduction. There is an ample supply of space in Richmond that can be adaptively reused to accommodate live workspaces for artists, and there are cultural assets that attract creative entrepreneurs to the city. Ms. Fontenla has her master's from the Department of Urban Studies and Regional Planning at the Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs at VCU, and she's with us today on Open Source RVA to talk about her proposal, which you can read by going to our website at rvaopensource.com. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, let's talk about how this all came out, came about. The plan was sponsored by the Public Art Commission. They requested it. How did the origins? What were the origins?
Well, this is my capstone project. It's called a Studio 2 for the Master's in Urban and Regional Planning. And I had this idea about affordable housing for artists and affordable studio space. And I really wanted to look at what was possible for artists to have an economically feasible place to live and work within the city of Richmond. So I approached John Beliles, who was the coordinator of the Public Arts Commission at the time. This is last spring. And he liked the idea, and he said that he would be willing to sponsor the project. So I worked with him, and I worked with Sally Bowring, who was the
commissioner
of the Public Arts Commission. And they were very helpful in moving this along and looking at all the different aspects of artist live workspace and the potential in Richmond.
Your introduction in the plan says it very well, but summarize for us why it's important to address the issue of live workspaces for artists.
I look at artists as independent business owners and as entrepreneurs and as people that enhance the community in a multitude of ways. And what's important about live workspace is that artist live workspace just doesn't fall into one particular category. You just can't have what is commonly known as like an artist loft. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work for artists because it's such a, the arts in general are such a diverse industry.
Right.
And as a diverse industry, they have different needs for whatever it is that they are creating.
Yeah, you can't just stick them in an apartment and say problem solved.
No, absolutely not. And since the needs of the arts industry are so diverse, you can't have a potter working in the same space as a painter. Mm-hmm. Or you can't have a weaver in the same space as a musician.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So because of that, I really started thinking about, you know, what are the needs of artists? And we had, for this research project, we had focus groups, an online survey,
mm-hmm.
Interviews with artists.
Yeah, how many total people were interviewed? I know you can't say who, but give me a sense of how many.
I'm really proud of the arts community in Richmond because this was a very quick study. This study had to happen in under 90 days. This,
huh?
Yeah, I know. Wow. Talk about deadlines.
Yeah.
But the preparation was obviously longer than that. But what I started with were some interviews with artists in the Richmond community, and I did about 20 interviews. And from those interviews, I developed a survey, an online survey.
Mm-hmm.
And the survey was available online for 30 days, and in 30 days, I had over 150 participants.
Wow.
And the feedback from the artists was incredible. And they pretty much reiterated themselves in the focus groups. There were three focus groups. And, you know, they said that they do need affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And they do need affordable spaces to create.
Right.
And it is beneficial for them to have their space for working on the same property as their space for living, but not exactly in the same structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for a multitude of reasons. For health reasons, for their sanity, for having, you know, you don't always want to live with your work. But it was great because, you know, the artists were very, they're very interested in the concept of live workspace and expanding that mm-hmm. throughout the city.
Right.
So if I had to, I guess that would be over just around, if not right at 200 artists.
Wow. Okay. And they were all artists.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. What did you learn from the results of this survey that you didn't know before, or something that surprised you, or maybe underlined what you already knew? Or
you know what I think it reiterates? That artists are just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
When they're looking for a home, they're not looking for anything different than any other person. A safe place to live, a neighborhood that's walkable, a community where they can have an impact, a nice park. All of these were things that came up over and over again. And what is interesting to me is that artists have been used as a catalyst
mm-hmm.
to revitalize areas that are in urban decay. And some of the artists made it a point to say that, you know, they're not opposed to being a catalyst for redevelopment.
Because mm-hmm. you always hear about artists being canaries.
Right. And they are, artists are creative and they can make a space into something that's livable and inviting
mm-hmm.
and they can revitalize an area. But on the other side of that is that, you know, they're tired of being pushed out of the neighborhoods that they've established.
Right, right.
And I understand that. And I've been in that situation myself, so that's one of the reasons why I was interested in the research. But additionally, it from the interviews and the focus groups and from the online survey, there were particular neighborhoods that kept coming up
mm-hmm.
in the research.
For instance?
Well, for instance, Manchester,
mm-hmm.
Broad Street,
right.
Church Hill, Oregon Hill, Scott's Addition,
mm-hmm.
Carver, Greater Fulton, even Forest Hill, Barton Heights, Jackson Ward, you know, The Fan and Chaco Bottom. These are all areas that we are all familiar with
mm-hmm.
that where artists have lived and where have places where artists have chosen to have studio space and workspace.
Right.
So Richmond has a wealth of opportunity to encourage artists to live and work in this city.
One of the recommendations is that the city get a real arts coordinator. Talk about why that's important.
Well, the artists spoke at length in one focus group in particular about how they don't feel as though they have an advocate for their industry. Every industry has an advocacy group, you know.
Sometimes several.
Right.
Yes.
Or a merchants association or something like that. And the artist said, you know, they don't have a resource. They don't have a person or an agency or an organization that they can go to and say, where can I, I'm new in town and I need some studio space that is conducive for large sculpture.
Right.
And they don't have a person that they can go to and speak with about that.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, if an artist needs to get a loan for equipment, who do they go to?
Mm-hmm.
If an artist is looking for shared studio space or someone to collaborate with.
Or I was going to ask, or help with zoning.
Absolutely.
One thing you address that's really welcome is the city's labyrinthian and sometimes even nonsensical zoning rules. What would have to be done there?
Well, zoning is complicated, and one of the options within the city of Richmond is called a special use permit. That process can be lengthy and very expensive. Mm-hmm. It could be
controversial.
Right, and it could be a very arduous process for an artist who, for the most part, is an independent business owner and usually the sole proprietor. And as a person that's working long hours by themselves, that process can be somewhat overwhelming.
Yeah, your energy can be spent dealing with the zoning rather than the event or the project itself.
Right. So what would be advantageous is if there were a person, if there was a person that could really work with the artist through this process of either zoning or finding an appropriate location or working with them to amend a location that could be usable and meet the requirements. And there just doesn't seem to be a person that can work with them.
Or just finding someone who can just be straight with them and give them some answers would also be.
Right.
That's pretty key. You have a historical background in the plan. And it stopped in the 1930s, and that seemed to leave out some of the more recent examples that touch upon what you're talking about. Explain that, why you didn't include things like the Shaco Bottom Art Center, which the artists were evicted in 2003.
You're absolutely right. That was a very important time, and
it illustrated the problem for one.
Absolutely,
thing.
And you know, it had a positive and negative effect on the arts community in Richmond.
Yeah, explain.
And one of the negative effects is, you know, the artists had to leave the studio space where many of them collaborated and many of them had met and worked with each other. Mm-hmm. And it made some of the artists lose contact with each other.
Right. And leave town.
Unfortunately, yes. Some of the artists did leave the city of Richmond and go to other places. But on the other side of it, looking in a positive way, what it did was it moved the artists to Manchester. Some of them went to Manchester.
Right.
Some of them went to the Near West End. Some went to Church Hill. And what it did was it kind of spread the artists among the city, which is not a bad thing.
Right, right. Yeah.
I mean, some of the artists really planted some roots in great neighborhoods and revitalized neighborhoods.
Right.
And that was a good thing. But that did come up often in the interviews and in the focus groups because the artists felt as though they were a catalyst for revitalizing Shaco Bottom.
Yeah.
And
where was their reward?
Exactly.
Folks bring that up because it seems kind of contradictory to this notion that we foster our creative community. And it didn't seem like anyone was willing to step up and help or to present a solution to that problem when it came up. And it was a similar thing in 1984 when artists were evicted from the Masonic Temple building.
Right.
It seems like this is a problem that's been going on for a long time. Why do you think no one has tried to address it until recent years?
in my humble opinion, I don't think there's been a strong advocate for the arts. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's been a strong advocate for artists. They've had to be advocates for themselves.
Yeah.
And it's a tough job. It's a tough job to be an entrepreneur and to be an artist. Mm-hmm. And it's a long and it's a long, passionate job that they care about very much. And they're not doing this because they're going to make a lot of money and they're mm-hmm. going to get a lot of notoriety. They do this because they care and because they're passionate about their work. Doesn't leave a whole lot of extra time for them to advocate for themselves.
Yeah.
And it would be great if there was an advocate within city government mm-hmm. or with a local agency or organization, or if something were created for artists.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the feedback you got. Do people think that this is a community that respects artists and the creative community? Or do people have a chip on their shoulder, or are they a little more optimistic?
I didn't really meet anyone that had a serious chip on their shoulder. I know that it can be very difficult, and I did hear some frustrations with certificate of occupancies for studio space, for zoning, for some of the bureaucratic processes that are in place for studio space and having a studio and housing on the same lot. Mm-hmm. But also I heard a lot of positive feedback about how Richmond is a great place to live. Mm-hmm. It's a great place for artists. Many artists that I interviewed have come to Richmond from other places.
Right.
And they've come here because it is affordable. It's easy to navigate. It's a growing cultural community. Mm-hmm. And Richmond has a lot of wonderful assets that they're looking for. They're looking for great outdoor space. They're looking for a good walkable community. Mm-hmm. They're looking for other artists to collaborate with.
Right.
They're looking for a place that's on the edge of becoming something great, and they want to be part of that. And I found that to be very inspiring.
In the plan, you single out a firm, I think out of Minneapolis, called ArtSpace.
Yes.
That actually does this. This is what they do.
Yes.
They look into experts.
Work.
Really? Okay. Well, tell me a little about what they do and exactly why we would need them.
Well, they could also be used as a case study. I don't know if we need them exactly to come to Richmond. But what ArtSpace does is they will take a structure that is conducive for artists to live and work in that structure, and they look at low-income housing tax credits, mm-hmm. so there is affordable housing for artists.
Right.
They also look at creating collaborative space and meeting space, and they look at what type of artists live in the community mm-hmm. that would need studio space.
Right.
And so it's a long process, but they also work with the local government to determine which spaces the local government is interested mm-hmm. in turning over to ArtSpace. So there's it's a long development, mm-hmm. but they have been very successful, and they have a large portfolio of spaces throughout the United States.
And you say the Public Art Commission has your plan and has had it for a while?
Yes.
Where does it go from here?
Well,
that's the big question, is who would be considering this for implementation?
Well, I think part of the good news is that the Public Arts Commission has gone through some changes in the last 12 months. And one of those changes is that John Beliles has been elected to city council.
Right.
And that's great.
Yeah.
He's really...
Obviously a public art advocate.
He helped
put the street art festival on and so on and so forth.
He's a great advocate for the arts and a nice person.
And then Parker Agelasto.
Absolutely.
Also with an arts background.
Absolutely. And there are some other professionals and stakeholders that have joined the Public Arts Commission. And, you know, it's good to mix things up, and change is always great.
Mm-hmm.
But also, as a community, we need to support our arts community.
Right.
And attending the Public Arts Commission meetings mm-hmm. and supporting efforts that enhance the creativity in the city. So this plan has a lot of elements to it, and the Public Arts Commission does have the plan. And, you know, government usually take, it's an incremental process.
Right, right.
And it
I
takes
would reference that teeming pile of plans that I spoke yeah. of before. You know, one hopes this wouldn't just sit on top of it.
Right, and that's what planning is about, is, you know, looking at what the goals are and the ways to achieve the goals and coming up with strategies. And I think that we're at a place where, you know, Richmond is looking to make some great changes, and I hope that this can contribute to those changes. And the Public Arts Commission, I think, works very hard mm-hmm. to enhance the creative community
well,
in the city.
They're about to get more money to play with, it looks like.
I hope so.
In 2014 and 15, looks like their budgets or their money allocation is going to go right. way, way up.
That would be so great.
I've been talking to Katrina Fontenla, who's a master of urban and regional planning at the L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs. She's coordinated and put together a plan to accommodate artists' live workspaces in Richmond's neighborhoods, requested by the Richmond Public Art Commission. To access this plan, which is a must-read if you have any interest in the future of Richmond's grassroots arts community, go to the Open Source RVA Facebook page and also rvaopensource.com. We've got a link there to her proposal. Thanks so much for coming on Open Source RVA.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, April 5th. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Amy Daniel and Don Harrison. Our producers are Gabby Schatzi, Jay Westerman, and Andrew Hawes. Mike McKenzie is taking some much-deserved time off after hiking Kilimanjaro. Enjoyed this week's Open Source? You can listen again to this and past episodes by going to rvaopensource.com. Also, don't forget to like us on Facebook, and you really should drop us a line. We love getting comments, suggestions, and complaints at opensourcerva.com. Till next week.
Vibrations coming to play when you're feeling the sky.